Welcome to After the Buzzer. I'm Mike Gross, and he's Gordy Jones, alongside in the big broadcast center, undisclosed location somewhere in America. And it's NFL time, lots and lots of stuff going on in the NFL. It's almost like the Super Bowl is story number two or three on the on the docket right now. But anyway, we have an NFL guy who's been with us before, an old pal of ours who covers the New England Patriots for the Boston Herald, to break it all down. Andrew Callahan, welcome back to the big show.
Thank you very much. I hope I'm getting paid by the hour because we're actually breaking this all down. We will be on way into the night.
So. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, you're not getting paid by the hour. I can promise you that. Or else you're getting paid the same hourly rate regardless, which is the null set. All right. Let's start with this. It seems to me that the Los Angeles Rams have become a great defense. How did that happen?
Well, I think you start with great players, right? You
know, yeah.
Guys have been there for a number of years. They had Jalen Ramsey a couple seasons ago. They were ahead of the curve last year in terms of, there's been this sweeping change across the league where you see a lot more two high defenses in the way that they just prioritize, pass first and run second, understanding that a big pass play is going to hurt you a lot quicker. And, be a lot more devastating in a series of short runs. So I think when you get the players to fit that scheme and players can kind of dominate their one-on-one matchups, it alleviates pressure on your lesser players. And so it's a combination of always a good coaching and good players.
Now, here's the sort of companion question to that. How did the Kansas City Chiefs at some point during the game last week become a bad offense?
Yeah, it's funny. I was actually just rewatching this all 22 from that game because I was very curious about that as well. And on the surface, there are smaller, probably more revealing answers to this. But you look at some of the adjustments the Bengals made, and they played a lot more 8-man coverages.
Yeah, we'll
give Mahomes a lot more time, but we're just going to clog all the passing lanes, keep a man over top of Tyreek Hill, double Kelsey on occasion, and just force him to be patient, and he couldn't. They did a little bit of that in the first half, but it was a lot more in the second. And it's funny, I tweeted at the time, it's something the Patriots did a lot for home from their last matchup and had similar results.
Yeah, that's it's funny because so many people, and I sort of lean this way a lot of times too, so many people think getting pressure on the quarterback is so important, it's indefensible to rush three people. I know a lot of people who just say that flatly. It's 100% of the time. This is as good an example as I think I've ever seen in the modern passing game era of rushing three and having it work, right?
Yeah. I mean, of course, it depends on who you're playing, right?
Sure.
They don't have the weapons that the Chiefs do. You're, speaking about just a generic opponent. Like, no one should have really been dropping eight against Penn State, let's say. and take care of him. But get some pressure on Clifford, because we saw how he kind of wilted an extra rusher in his face. So, that goes for a lot of quarterbacks, but not like Mahomes, who is pretty much immune to any single coverage, but he's not immune to taking away his best weapons, which, of course, is, among the hardest tasks in the NFL when you're talking about future Hall of Famer Kelsey, probable future Hall of Famer Tyreek Hill. But, you do that, and Mahomes can only scramble around for so long.
It seems like, I'm sure you read Seth Wickersham's book about the Patriots, and it seemed like this was a case where the Bengals kind of took a page out of the Belichick book from the standpoint of they had a read on what Andy Reid is as a coach, and that is a guy who, come what may, will not run the ball, which you should do against a three-man front. It almost seemed like they took that kind of a Belichickian approach, like, okay, you're not going to run it, so we're just going to have all these guys covering your guys, and you're not going to be able to do anything. Is that too abstract a read on my part, or what do you think about that?
I think there's an element of that, but it was funny because they ran the ball so well in that first half where he's able to set themselves up with these second and ones and second and threes.
Right.
But part of it, I think Mahomes just got really spooked for whatever reason, and again, looking at second half, which started with that final play before halftime, right, where he literally cost him three, if not seven points there, by failing to score as the half expired. So I think he might have carried that over into the second half, and then he saw that pick in overtime, that prevents this great advantage of them getting the ball first, for maybe leading them to the Super Bowl. So I think it was more on Mahomes than Andy Reid, but there's no doubt the Chiefs, like a lot of teams, they don't just want to win. They want to win their way.
Right.
And there are degrees of that, but that that's where you take that kind of stubbornness and turn it against them. But again, you can't do that if you know if the players on the other side, if they're in the first half, specifically Mahomes, are just out executing you. And he definitely fell apart during the second half.
It was hard to believe, really, because I almost read the for them going for it at the end of the first half. It was one of those things. Well, if we don't get it, we'll be able to score X number of points in the second. Yeah. But there was a certain arrogance in that approach to it. What was your read on that?
Yeah, that's tough to say because it was just so shocking, right? I mean, I think you credit the Bengals obviously for making that comeback, and a lot of their defensive approach had some success. But the way they were able to keep pressure on them, from kind of a scoreboard standpoint, was Joe Burrow extending plays and doing a lot of things that Mahomes did. So I think for them, credit goes to them for kind of keeping up and applying that same pressure as much as anything that the Chiefs kind of screwed up. It was excellence on both sides for the Bengals. So I think they're still kind of playing ahead of their skis, if you will. Mm-hmm. But it's just one of these games that, you remember for a lot of different reasons. And I think there was as many good things that happened for Cincinnati as they were bad for the Chiefs.
Yeah, that playing ahead of their skis, that's interesting. And that can maybe get us going toward the next game. Cincinnati looks to me like they have a mediocre offensive line, and that ought to be prohibitive of getting to or winning the Super Bowl. But obviously it's not. What are they doing right that sort of – do you agree that they have a mediocre offensive line? And if so, how are they making it work despite that?
Yeah, I would say, first of all, they do, definitively, statistically. Yeah. You could say, hey, they're in the Super Bowl. They're a great team. That's true. They are a Super Bowl team, but it doesn't mean all of their flaws or weaknesses, are suddenly masked over and matured into all these strengths. Any team that's gone to the Super Bowl has not been a perfect team, including the 2007 Patriots, and we know how that ended as an 18-0 team that finished 18-1. So for the Bengals, I think they make up for these negative plays, which on defense, right, if you get a sack, that's basically the defensive version of a 20-yard gain, because you understand that the impact that has on the likelihood of that drive, to score if you get a sack, just drops it down to the floor. Similarly, if you complete a 20 or 30-yard pass, your likelihood of scoring on that drive is astronomical. So what they do to nullify that is they just get more explosive plays. Okay, you set us back in second 14 with a sack. We're going to find Jamar Chase on a post or a go or a corner or whatever it is. And that's where the strength of their offense is. So they understand they're going to take their lumps in protection. But so long as Joe Burrow can scramble for a couple first downs, they're going to hit Chase deep. They're going to hit Tyler Boyd. And that's really where the power of their offense, I think their team is just getting those big chunk plays.
Burrow, this is understandable given the run they're on, but Burrow has kind of gone from, I think a lot of people would have put just, 2 months ago, a lot of people would have put Justin Herbert a little bit ahead of him. A lot of people would have put some of these other very young quarterbacks a little bit ahead of him. Now he's moving to the head of the class. And other than the fact that he's playing in the Super Bowl, but beyond that, what do you see in him that's so extraordinary?
Yeah, I think it's hard to describe it essentially, because you would want to lean into all the cliches, right? Let's just say a kind of white, not unathletic quarterback, but he's just athletic enough where he's pretty, he's got a quick release, he's smart. But they kind of fit for Joe Burrow, because when you watched him, post all those astronomical numbers at LSU, where sure, he was surrounded by, pro-level talent at that time, including Justin Jefferson now with Minnesota and Jamar Chase. He was still making big-time throws. And I think his willingness to stand in the pocket, his aggression downfield, and just that kind of gutsiness to make those throws time and again, combined with his, really strong accuracy, makes him special. So the stuff on the margins where he's able to scramble again on 3rd and 7, I think pushes him ahead, where he's ahead of schedule and his development is great. But, I mean, he checks off every box that you've always needed to check off in the NFL to have great quarterbacking. You can win from the pocket, you're tough, and you're accurate. So, anything else is gravy, and right now they're swimming in it with his ability, again, to kind of scramble in that second half and get in the city to get them to the Super Bowl.
Yeah, that was big in that game, sure. let's go a little bit to the matchup. What do you think in terms of sort of X and O, maybe not X and O, but just deep understanding of what these teams are about? How do you think, what are a couple of things that might swing it toward the Rams or toward the Bengals?
I mean, I don't know what the odds are in Aaron Donald for Super Bowl MVP, but whatever they are, lock it in right now. Like, that's where my attention is going up front. and in some ways this is an oversimplification and cliche, is one of the trenches and lost, but I think he could single-handedly destroy this game, because we didn't hear a whole lot from him against San Francisco, because the Niners do year in and year out a good job of kind of neutralizing him, but he showed up there in the fourth quarter, and Cincinnati is not equipped to handle him, specifically when they run these kind of 5 and 6 man protections that put all the receivers out in their routes and let Burrow kind of pick and choose his matchup. Mm-hmm. If you do that, he's going to get to Burrow more often than not, and Burrow's going to find a guy downfield. So I think that's where it comes down to. How well can they neutralize or suffer at the hands of Aaron Donald? You know, because otherwise, Jalen Ramsey versus Jamar Chase is fun, but the Rams don't use Jalen Ramsey as a traditional kind of Darrelle Revis, or, you know, even saw Stephon Gilmore for a little bit in New England, where he travels with opposing number one wide receiver. They can, but he plays more in the slant. So I really think it's just going to be, you know, the Rams' defense. Can you prevent those big plays that they're built to do? And how much damage does Aaron Donald do up front, where you don't even have to worry about your coverage because he's just getting there so quickly?
Mm-hmm. Hmm. What do you think about Matthew Stafford's season? It's been sort of an odd one because he's had some really horrendous weeks. But, you know, obviously he's got him here, so he's had enough. The balance sheet is tilted heavily in his favor. What is the problem with him when he struggles? What is he seeing that doesn't work out for him on those bad days?
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I think, you know, because I had to explore, you know, the possibility he might end up in New England, right? When we knew they'd have a new regime change in Detroit. He's on the block, wants a trade, eventually, of course, goes to L.A. But, you know, looking at his tape back then and even statistically, he's just a good quarterback. And it's boring analysis, but he's annually somewhere in the top 8, the top 12, when you're evaluating him against the rest of the league. And by definition, those guys are not going to be elite week in and week out. But more often than not, you can win with them. I think what you see here in the structure, you know, and the talent of that Rams offense is, you know, he's playing more of the top 8 than top 12. And so he struggled down for the second half of the season. But I think that was as much a function of the offense lifting him up early as dragging him down late. Because even going to Jared Goff's numbers, he would have some hot starts in the season with Sean McVay. But inevitably, teams would kind of pick up on some of their tendencies where they don't do a whole lot of plays. But when you would get them in certain looks pre-snap, they knew where they were going to go with the ball. And when you have a quarterback like Jared Goff, or even Matt Stafford, who's more bound to the pocket and can't improvise, you know, you have an advantage. So once the Rams, again, solve those problems late, where defenses picked up what they were doing, Stafford goes back to being a top 8 guy as opposed to top 12, and that's why they're making this run. He's playing good football because he's a good quarterback.
Where do you put Cooper Kupp in the pantheon of great receivers in the NFL right now? Because he looks like a pretty complete player, right down to, you know, mixing it up as a blocker too. Where would you put him?
I mean, in terms of single season production, you know, I know he set all these records. He's got to be somewhere top 10 all time. That even includes, you know, all the qualifiers of, you know, he's in the all time passing era. We had a 17 game season for the first time ever. But his ability to win inside and out, off the line initially or deep, like, he does it all for them. Because similarly, like we talked about, you know, if you want to go back to that Green Bay game and Devontae Adams, incredible receiver, but a large reason that the Packers lost is because the Niners took him away, and you just haven't seen anyone be able to do that with Cooper Kupp. So it's again, he's in a good environment with the coach being the quarterback, but you know, he's the offensive player of the year, and I don't think it's close.
I saw Micah Parsons of not that Micah Parsons is necessarily an authority, but he tweeted the other day, Cooper Kupp is the best edit player in the NFL, and it's not even close. I mean, I don't know about that, but he's certainly in the top.
Damn good. He's
in the top
good.
10, right?
Yeah, he's damn good.
He is a great football player.
And like I said, he's got courage, too. Devontae Adams does not want to hit people.
Oh, yeah. He's
Cooper Kupp does.
He's a football player. You can see him playing safety or something like that.
Let's
talk just briefly a little bit, Andrew, about a quarterback. I'm just bringing this up because I know that you've got to be familiar with him covering the Patriots, and it's a guy that I'm just amazed by, Josh Allen. I can't believe how athletic he is, and I can't believe what a great player he's become. I really thought they were going to go out to Kansas City and win. But anyway, you probably have spent some time on him. Give us your sense of Josh Allen a little bit.
Yeah, well, two things on that. You know, you can't believe how good he's been. I'll tell you this, the Patriots can't either. I think they've only kind of finally come to the realization that, look, this guy is legit, and not only just in terms of being a starting caliber quarterback, but a top 5-1 in the league. And what I wrote after the Bills came in week 16 to beat New England, which was kind of like de facto division title game right there, because the winner gets the AFC East, unless they puke themselves on the stretch, which the Patriots did anyway, was that he kind of passed Bill Belichick's final test. Because early on in that game, Belichick was doing things you would see him test Peyton Manning with, you know, in the early 2000s, where when he would run up against a guy like Aaron Rodgers or now Patrick Mahomes, which is, we're going to disguise a lot of coverage, but more often than not, it's going to end up in these kind of like two deep coverages. It might be cover two, it could be cover four, we might do some cover three, but it'll be soft, and we're just going to force you to be patient, and you're going to need to make all of these short throws time and again and again. Josh Allen had no problem against that, and then when they would mix it up with a pressure here or there, he knew how to exploit that or play kind of, you know, mismatch one-on-one ball against when they were in man and find Isaiah McKenzie, who's a slot receiver they don't know, but that's better than the Patriots player who is defending him. So they go up to Buffalo. They don't have many cards left to play. It's the same thing. He was patient when he needed to be. He went deep when he had the opportunities and just picked them as his best match. So I think, honestly, to me, I thought that game in Kansas City was the de facto Super Bowl. Of course, how wrong am I? I think we had probably the weirdest matchup of my lifetime in the Super Bowl, but he's outstanding. And I think they're realizing that he's going to be a real problem for the next 10 years.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's impressive. He was really impressive.
Yeah, no doubt. Now let's go to Tom Brady a little bit. I'm sure you've heard of him, Andrew. I sort of felt when he started making noises around the end of regular season, which sounded to me like I really think he's going to retire. When he started saying it's not about me, it's about being. Giving my family what they deserve from me and all that kind of stuff, I started to think, wow, I really think he might be done now. What's your sense of how it played out at the end? And did you kind of see it coming?
I didn't see it coming just because, you know, this is a guy who said, look, I'm not going to retire when I suck. I'm going to get ahead of that. But he's not even close to being average still. He led the league in passing, touchdowns,
yards,
completions, all of it. That team goes back to the playoffs. Should have won at home if that defense just doesn't totally collapse there late. And this guy who, you know, was down a few weapons. Dude, people forget Chris Godwin gone, Antonio Brown, you know, had a 10. So it was basically him and Mike Evans. And I just thought he had another year. Because next year also would have been his age 45 season. He's been talking about playing until 45 in the last 10 years. And
yeah,
he's
that's true.
Than that. But I think it was really, like you said, about family. That's what swayed him. But, you know, his other ventures as far as the TB12 company, he's got a production company too. And a Brady brand that's dipped into clothing. I think, you know, some stuff that no one who's not close to him could really quantify is how fulfilling that is. And the sense that I get is that stuff is ready to kind of, you know, fill the place and the hole in his life that football will leave, where you can only kind of get that competitive juice and that deep day sense. So I don't know how it's doing that, but he got a lot on his plate to go off the field, and I think he's fine stepping away knowing he can dive full time into all of that.
And it kind of puts into place now this. The kind of the changing of the guard with him and Roethlisberger retiring, Drew Brees having retired. How do you, if you were a betting man, who's the quarterback in Tampa Bay, Pittsburgh, and maybe Green Bay for that matter next year?
Oh boy, testing in here. Well, I'll go Green Bay. You know, I'll just say Jordan Love right now. I think they'd love to keep him, but that cap is a mess.
It is.
And there are plenty of teams that can make kind of godfather offers where you go. You know, Love's not only just been here for 2 years. He was a first-round pick. They've had designs on this for a while, and they got to clean up their cap. As far as Tampa, you know, someone floated today the idea of Jameis Winston coming back. I don't hate that. You know, he's got that kind of downfield mentality, which, you know, dragged Tampa Bay down, but he's familiar with that offense. He's got a strong enough arm to play like Bruce Arians wants him to play, but, you know, they might like Kyle Trask because they took out of Florida in the second round last year, so maybe he'll have a say there. And then as far as Pittsburgh, that's another tough one. I mean, I could see Jameis there too. Mike Tomlin's, you know, on the record multiple times saying he wants a more mobile quarterback. Jameis isn't a statue, but he's close. So, you know, it's really tough to say. But the next Steelers quarterback will be able to kind of extend plays like we haven't seen Ben Roethlisberger do for a while. So those are my best guesses. Yeah, maybe, you know, maybe Jimmy G goes to Tampa, like, you know, the guy finally succeeds Brady once again.
My brothers-in-law, who are a Steelers fan, were teasing me after Jimmy imploded against the Rams that Jimmy G's going to end up in Green Bay next year. So. But Rodgers maybe to Denver? That seems to be the smart money seems to be going in that direction. Is that seems realistic, at least. I mean, they just hired his offensive coordinator, and I guess Getsy went there as well, so.
Yeah, we'll see. You know, they had only been in Green Bay for, what, 2 or 3 years. They were 9-4.
Right.
So, you know, I don't think the pull there was strong. But wherever place the Rodgers want to go to next, I think will be an area where, you know, the team is lay out the red carpet for him and let him have a lot more say in the front office. I'm not sure that'll be Denver. We got a second-year PM in Jordan Patton, who's, you know, I think did a solid job, just got to hire that coach of his choosing. So they're going to, I think, want to have some more say over how things to run in Denver. And, you know, we know Aaron's going to want to have more power than that. So it'll be an interesting dynamic. I'm not sure what his market is. You would think that it would be pretty much any team would be out there, like an NBA superstar. When they hit the market, everyone's out there to, you know, open their doors and make a pitch. It'll be interesting because we know things have gotten a little bit more complicated with Rodgers the last few years.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Andrew, going back to the first meeting between the Bills and the Patriots in the crazy weather, that was like a football game from 1965 in terms of the way it was played, and you know, everybody, I heard so many people say, well, look at Belichick, he figured it out, and he found a way, you know, but when men are men and the football is tough, you know, whatever. But what happened to the Patriots from there on? Like, what was, I know that obviously they have some limitations on their roster, but what do you think happened to that team from that point forward?
Yeah, it's a good question. And a lot of players have even said, which is unusual, as you guys even know, for how they speak in New England, it's just that something did change after the fact. The problem was they just couldn't put their finger on it. And I think a couple things you can definitively say is that the team, you know, probably regressed to the mean a little bit. They were playing better than that team to be when they're on a 7-game winning streak, beat Buffalo, beating the, you know, breaks off the Browns, even beat the Titans here at home, even if the Titans were limited down a bunch of their top weapons. So they regressed a little bit, and they played a harder schedule. So that, too, is where the margins are going to be very thin. You know, for all intents and purposes, you lose by one score at Indianapolis, given that long touchdown run late. Buffalo doesn't punt in the rematch in Foxborough. You go down to Miami, and at that point, it's just a team that had some bad habits. So I think it was just they probably, you know, leaned a little bit too far into, hey, we're a legit number one seed, and started feeling themselves. And then when you just are up a little bit, and Mac Jones as a quarterback naturally hit some sort of wall, or it wasn't, you know, a significant drop-off. But again, the margins are smaller when you're getting into December and January and the competition goes up. You can't afford those mistakes. They just didn't have those in the 7 games that they won before that. And I think it was just kind of, you know, just everything coming together at the wrong time for an imperfect storm. Or if they weren't that team, everyone knew it. But then things got even worse with those last two losses, of course, at Buffalo before that in Miami.
If I was Rex Ryan or Michael Wilbon, I would now excoriate you for using the phrase regression to the mean. God, I'm so tired of that nonsense. These anti-analytics people who don't understand analytics. But anyway, what do you think the quarterback's upside is? How do you think he did in year one? And what do you think he's sort of capable of?
You know, I kind of go along with maybe the most popular comparison among Mac Jones optimists last year during the draft process, and that was Matt Ryan. And I think, you know, he's this year statistically, honestly, he was right on par with Matt Ryan, though Matt Ryan, of course, in the twilight of his career. I think he exceeded expectations as a rookie. And, being a rookie, I think, played to all of his initial strengths, right? Like, this is a kid who knows three languages, graduated in 4 years, yes, even if it was from Alabama, with a master's degree. He's very smart. He's very accurate. And those are the primary characteristics you need in an offense where he's got everything on his plate pre-snap, and they need the ball out of there in 2.5 seconds.
Yeah.
So that's how Brady operated. That's how he thrived. And so if you needed a couple things to succeed right away in New England, that's it. So he has that. But now what can he do to kind of raise up the weaknesses in his game to an average level? You know, can he get a little bit faster and more mobile where you see, again, we've talked about this with Joe Burrow, of course, Josh Allen, that was evident. You know, what can you do when things aren't perfect in the play and it goes longer than 2.5 seconds? Because that's where he struggled. And so I think, you know, he might not get to that Matt Ryan level, but I think you can win with Mac Jones. It's just a matter of how good is your supporting cast, which honestly, that's the same question that applies to, you know, probably every quarterback in the league, except for maybe 5 or 6.
So I guess the other topic we wanted to throw around with you is just Brian Flores, the Dolphins coach, suing the NFL for discriminatory hiring practices. And one of the things mentioned in the suit, there's one white head coach, which is Mike Tomlin, one black head coach, Mike Tomlin, 4 black offensive coordinators, 11 black defensive coordinators, 8 black special teams coaches, three black quarterback coaches and six black GMs. And the Rooney Rule is well-intentioned, but it certainly doesn't seem like it addresses the larger problem. What is your take on how this is going to play out?
Yeah, it's really difficult to say, because I think when the NFL comes out two hours after Brian Flores' suit is filed, and their statement says, all of these claims are meritless, which, first of all, how do you know that?
It's impossible to know that, yeah.
Yeah, it's impossible. You're telling on yourself that you're already, excuse my French, full of shit.
Yeah.
So they're going to do everything in their power to mitigate and nullify and quiet this story. And the real power of how far it goes and whether the whole league gets swept up in this, I think is going to depend on what other coaches step up and voice their own experiences that obviously Brian Flores has done, because this is a class action suit that leaves it open to, you know, other plaintiffs joining him. And if no one does, I think you can explain some of the instances away, whether they're right or not. But if you're in court arguing on behalf of the league, you go, look, John Elway's not racist. You know, he just might be a jerk who shows up late. You know, Stephen Ross, you know, didn't do anything. He was the guy who hired Brian Flores. And then the Giants, you know, sure, but we really considered you. And there's no way to know. Yeah. You can just say Bill Belichick had bad intel. And I think that gets harder to kind of BS your way out of this if you're the league. But clearly, statistically, you know, the numbers you just rattled off, when you consider one black head coach out of 32, or, you know, we're 28 right now with the vacancies, you know, if you were really hiring the best coach, that percentage wouldn't be that low. When the percentage of black applicants is much higher than 1 out of 28, it would be more representative for who's being hired, for who's applying. But again, the league can probably explain away in the court of public opinion in actual courts if it's just one man. But if, you know, all these other experiences are starting to be voiced and you see other assistants stand up, not only just from, you know, different positions as opposed to head coaches, but other teams that don't involve the Dolphins, Giants, and Broncos, then I think this gets much bigger. But for now, it's, you know, we just have to see.
Yeah, to that point, I mean, Eric Bieniemy apparently has had 20 head coaching interviews and not gotten a job. Terrell Austin, 10. Chris Richard, 5. And then you have a case like Jim Caldwell, who coached the Lions, of all teams, to a 563 winning percentage in 4 seasons, and he gets fired. So it's just, something ain't right. I don't know what the corrective is, but
yeah,
something ain't right.
Yeah, it's difficult too, right? Because, you know, and I was having this conversation with someone I'm close with yesterday who didn't kind of understand all the details. And my way was to explain, you know, we're not dealing with racism as it was initially addressed and known, where you had signs that were literally in black and white, separating people black from white. And there's an easy way to fix that. You make laws, you take those signs down. This is implicit systemic bias, where you really have to reverse engineer, you know, okay, here's the data. And you have to trace it back to, how are these decisions being made? And it's really just these inherent prejudices that really the ownership group has. And ownership, which is 30 out of the 32 NFL owners, are old white guys, which is not a crime unto itself, but get this idea in their head of what a coach looks like.
Yeah.
And historically, you're looking at Chuck Knoll, you're looking at Tom Landry, Bill Walsh, Vince Lombardi, now Bill Belichick, all older white guys. And so that's, it's harder to kind of correct the ownership and these prejudices that you have and go, you know, just because a coach is black doesn't mean he's suited more for defense than offense, where offense is associated with the Bill Walsh, you need to be a mastermind. They're all equally capable, and you need to sit down and meet with them. But I think it's, for somehow, if there's going to be change, it has to start with ownership, because right now, those are the people making the decisions and where the biases lie, but you only know it by the way that they're making their decisions, which obviously have a bias built in, because again, we have one black head coach and that's it.
How good a coach do you think Flores is? And you get to see him a couple times a year the last couple years. What do you think?
Yeah, my first season he was assistant in New England, and you could tell right then that players were really drawn to him. And I, you know, I've talked to people, especially since he got hired, you know, Miami agents and, you know, who have players down there with the Dolphins, and they said, look, he's a hard ass. You know, he kind of makes things a little bit harder for himself, is how difficult he is to work with. But if you're with him and you believe in him and you're behind him, things go really well. And this isn't kind of, you know, if you're on his good side or bad side, it's just kind of that similar hard patriot way style that he relates to players a little bit better. So I think he's a very good coach. His last 2 seasons in Miami, when they were not tanking, you know, both winning seasons, no, they didn't make the playoffs, but look, I don't think they have a very good quarterback down there or a good offensive line, which to me were decisions that should have gone with the front office. But he lost a power struggle with the GM there, Chris Kerr, and hired him. And I think Brian Flores is a better coach than Greer as a GM. But, you know, right now, the guy who's not as close with the owner is Adam Gaunt.
Mm.
It's a baffler. It really is strange. I don't know. All right, let's go. Gordy, you have something?
The one thing I just thing in the back of my mind that the way this is going to end is that Brian Flores is never going to coach in the NFL again. And I hope I'm wrong, but I almost feel like that's how this plays out.
Well, it's now at the place where he's either not going to coach in the NFL again, or he's going to, and it will be perceived as a tokenism type thing.
Yeah.
Right? It seems like...
Which I'm screwed up as the leader, that's our instinct.
Right? Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Some wrongs to light and try to make these wrongs right, that he's the one that fell for this. You know, but it's because, you know, who does Roger Goodell work for? The owners. The owners are now exposed that all these racist hiring practices are here. Because again, the percentage of applicants for all of these jobs is much higher than 1 out of 28 or 1 out of 32. If you're hiring for the best people, inevitably it'd be closer to 20 or 30%, which is the percentage of black applicants you have for head coaches and GMs. Mm-hmm. So,
right.
No question.
Just, it's going to be the owners playing hardball because these are billionaires. You know, either we're born on third base or work their way up, and now go, there's no reason for me to do anything other than what I want because this is how the league is operated. Mm-hmm. And again, I think it's going to be how much damage can Flores and any other coaches do before.
All right, let's get you on the record about the big game, Andrew. What's your best guess of how it might go, and who do you like?
I think this is a fast start for the Rams. Same reasons I mentioned earlier. Aaron Donald is, of course, you cannot prepare for until you see him on Sunday, and I think they get up to maybe kind of a 10-0, 13-0 lead. But Bengals being as explosive as they are, they get a big touchdown, and I think the Rams make a screw up late. Just like we saw in Tampa, the problem is it's just not enough screw-ups because the gap between these two teams, in my mind, is pretty significant. And I think the Bengals have been getting by in these one-score victories. Mm-hmm. Congrats to them for going into Kansas City, beating the Chiefs, Tennessee, and beating the Titans. I just don't see them getting out with a one-score win this time. And I think you probably see about like a 10 to 14-point Rams win.
Wow. So sometimes the better team wins because they're the better team. That's crazy talk.
Yeah, not this season, apparently, but here we are.
All right, my final question for you, Andrew Callahan. Have you exhausted your supply of Pappy Van Winkle?
I was very eager to kind of share that with the people close to me, who I knew would enjoy it and savor it. And honestly, I thought 7 months was good, but then I relayed that answer. People who know more about whiskey than me, and they think like I just poured it down the toilet. So it was shared with a lot of people, but I like to think I used it in the proper time and proper way.
Yeah. Yeah, all right,
exactly.
excellent. Andrew, thanks, man. We love to talk to you. Love to talk football with you, and we hope you're well up there in fabulous Boston. And we'll talk to you again.
Thanks, guys. My pleasure as always. I'm looking forward to the next one.
All right. Take care. Be well, Andrew.
See ya.
Bye. Andrew Callahan, ladies and gentlemen. Well, we didn't get to this. I just realized I had written this down because
it's not a big deal. It was just that we had the Washington football team took on the name Commanders this weekend. Tony Kornheiser on his podcast is saying, well, what's going to be the diminutive of that? The Commies?
Yes. The answer to that question is yes. It's going to be the Commies. How can people, this amazes me sometimes when people name their children. How can you not think, you have to name your child something that either breaks down easily to one syllable or close to that.
Yes.
I named my kids Ben and Adam. Okay,
there you go.
You know, because I didn't want, because if you don't give a name with a one syllable sort of version, you're essentially giving the world the right to call your kid, to name your kid in a way.
That's an interesting point.
and this is the same thing. How did it? Wasn't there a meeting in which within 5 minutes somebody said, you know, they're going to call us the Commies, and we're in Washington D.C.
This is a problem. The thing is, I guess the other ones that they considered were not great alternatives, like the Armada, or there were others that I forget, like the Admirals, which you throw that out right away. I don't know. But it just cracks me up that when he said that, the Commies.
Yeah, that's what it's going to be. They're going to be called the Commies. Congratulations.
Congratulations. So.
I liked Andrew's take. I mean, he's obviously so deeply into the X's and O's about, you know, how you're going to block Aaron Donald, especially, you know, we had a Bengals team that gave up 9 sacks 2 games ago to the Titans and somehow managed to win.
Yeah, they won a playoff game in which Burrow was sacked 9 times. It is a feast or famine, as Andrew said. It is a feast or famine offense, and they feasted a lot in that game. Yeah, you know, they made some big plays, and they have a Jamar Chase, whatever his name is.
Yeah.
Terrific wide receiver and college teammate of Burrow. And,
So that will bear watching because, you know, not only do you have to deal with Aaron Donald, you also have Von Miller, who's maybe not quite the player he was before, but he's been a Super Bowl MVP.
Yeah,
so.
and makes a play once in a while. He's at the stage of his career where, correct, you know, 2-3 times a game he guesses right or makes the swim move and gets in there, you know.
Yeah.
But he's still, still a force. Yeah.
And interesting, Nick Scott, Lancaster native Nick Scott, has played well. He had a big time. He had an interception against Tom Brady, and then this past game he had a big hit for a guy coming over the middle.
Yeah.
And another Penn State connection, Troy Reeder, who played at Penn State for a couple years and played well, and then transferred to Delaware. He's a starting linebacker.
And that was a weird kind of transfer thing. And boy, did that work out! And he landed. I'm so glad to see Nick Scott, who grew up in Lancaster. I'm so glad to see him. He now has made that transition, which I wasn't sure that he would make, from being a special teams guy to really being a legitimate safety. He's gotten a lot better, and he's playing because I'm not even sure who the guy is, but he's playing because of an injury. But still, he's played very well. The Pro Football Focus people who, you know, do that film analysis, they have been giving him great grades, and the last interception of Tom Brady's career was by
that?
Nick Scott, cutting in front of Rob Gronkowski.
Yeah, not too shabby.
There you go.
Yeah, I think Brady's retirement isn't surprising from this standpoint. The team, apparently, they have a lot of free agents, the Bucs, so I think he doesn't know what team he's coming back to.
I 100%. I think that's a piece of it,
And because I think Gronk is done, and, you know, Antonio Brown, of course, is never coming back and probably never coming back to the NFL at all, at least I kind of hope. I mean, after that display, on top of everything
else.
It's tiresome. And so I don't think he knows what the heck he's going to – I mean, he was great this year.
Yeah.
And this was interesting to me. The other day, you know how they do this thing on Twitter where they show headshots through the years? And it was like literally like a Benjamin Button thing.
Yeah,
like
I saw that too.
From Brady's rookie year to now. The guy looks better now than he did then. We should all master that.
Though. Yeah, definitely he looks better than he did as a really young kid.
Yes.
He's definitely better looking now.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I'm not an expert on male looks, I don't think. But
far as conditioning and such.
But I think in the middle of his career, he really sort of went male model a little bit. And so he may not look as good as he did then. But the beginning of his career, he definitely looks better now than he...
Yeah, one of the touchstones with Brady is the picture that was taken of him shirtless at the scouting combine, and there's no definition at all. If you were going to say that this is going to be the greatest quarterback of all time, then you would have had your head examined.
You know, it's an amazing story, and so often during his career, because the Patriots were, I think, perceived as the dark side, you know, and the Deflategate, and Belichick's seeming like Darth Vader, you know, and all of that. I think people got caught up in that and you know, rooting against the Patriots.
Sure.
I think now that he's retired, people are going to step back and perceive.
I would hope.
My opinion on him has changed a little bit. I have enormous respect for how well he has just handled everything. He really has knocked professionalism as a great athlete, celebrity, out of the park.
Yeah, he's really had a... Somebody pointed out that it's kind of interesting that, you know, he went 6-3 in Super Bowls with the Patriots, and he literally could have won every one of those or lost every one of those. They're all kind of like hanging. The one against the Eagles, maybe not the first one, where the Eagles kind of had that, you know, laborious drive when they needed to be like on the ball, and the Patriots are going, what are they doing? So that wasn't probably as close as the score was. But really, a lot of those games were like, you know, one play here
or
there.
That's right. If you look at them in the postseason over the course of his career, it's not like they were this juggernaut that was dominating people. And certainly they were the first time they lost to the Giants, I mean, they were clearly the better team there. But for whatever reason, whether it was something about the mental and emotional thing of being undefeated, I don't know what it was, but they were not themselves in that Super Bowl. And then 30 seconds after the game was over, it was Eli beat Brady in the Super Bowl.
Well, there were a lot. I mean, quarterback win-loss records are a little bit, you know, that's one of those stats that I don't think you can put a ton of stock in. I mean, you can put, it says something, but not everything.
Yeah.
You know?
But just being right there so many times. How many AFC championship games did you play?
I forget.
Or conference championship? 15?
It's ridiculous. It's in the teens. I mean, he's won 35 playoff games.
Yeah, to be in.
That's pretty ridiculous.
To be in that hunt over and over and over.
Now, here's an interesting perspective on it. If the tuck rule game never happens, if it's just ruled a fumble, does this all happen? You know? I mean, because that kind of set them up for, you know, everything that followed.
And there are so many things like that in sports. Yeah. You can, almost anybody's career, you can go back and take it apart and say, what about, it's that butterfly effect thing that people talk about. That's a real thing.
Yeah.
And anybody, just about anybody, you could do that with.
Yeah. Yeah. And here's something I've always wondered about too. If Brady and Rodgers switch places, does Rodgers win as many as Brady does?
What would the relationship between Belichick and Rodgers been like?
I don't know if that would have worked.
Yeah, I don't either. I don't know. I don't know that it wouldn't either. But it's one of those things, you know. And that, when we talk about go back and change things, I mean, the draft is the ultimate example of that. Like, what team you sort of randomly end up on.
That's one of those things I've always wondered about. You know, it's really kind of curious. But you're right. I mean, the Belichick-Rodgers thing, I think that would have been...
Certainly at a certain point, when Rodgers got older, and clearly he thinks he knows everything. And I think I'm not even killing him by saying that. But,
no,
I mean, because he does know a lot. I think he's a really smart guy. He's
as smart as he thinks he is.
It's not possible to be as smart as he thinks he is. And we're living in an age when smart people say and do dumb things. And that's one of the most confounding things about our time, the times we live in.
Yes. Do we want to take a little left turn, and the NBA trade deadline is 1 week away from today. Do we want to talk Ben Simmons, or have we exhausted that topic?
Let's talk a little Ben Simmons.
I mean, the news this week was there was a long story on ESPN.com by Ramona Shelburne, a very well-respected NBA writer, in which the thing that stood out to me was that one of the things about Ben is upset with Joel Embiid because Joel buried him, quote-unquote, after the series against Atlanta last year, whereas Ben did not bury Joel after the series against Toronto in 2019, which, first of all, read the room. Secondly, if you go back to plus-minus in that series when Embiid was on the floor and when he wasn't, it's astronomical. I mean, the Game 7, he was a plus-10 in a game they lost by two. Greg Monroe, you know, shout out to Greg, he played like some minimal amount of time. He was a minus 12. I mean, now speaking of misleading stats, plus minus is far from a perfect stat. But in that case, I think it speaks volumes.
Well, not only that, but in that season and even the year, was it the year before? Was it the first year he played at all? Well, whatever. But anyway, my point is the plus minus was so extreme comparing Embiid when he's on the floor to whoever is playing center for the Sixers when Embiid is not on the floor. It was unbelievable. You couldn't ignore it. You couldn't dismiss it. Yeah.
No, so I'll be curious to see. I suspect now that that Daryl Morey is going to stick to his guns and hold on to him through the season, and I guess they're going to make a run at Harden. And I'm wrestling with a lot of things as far as, you know, the shoot for the stars guys, you know, Damian Lillard, James Harden, Bradley Beal, because Harden, he doesn't strike me as a guy that really takes care of himself, and he's heading toward his mid-30s. Yeah. Do you really want to commit to him? I mean, he's obviously had a great career, But do you really want to commit to him when you think that he could just fall off a cliff?
He could fall off a cliff, yeah. I mean, he's kind of got a funky body type,
yes.
too. He carries a lot of weight.
And yes.
Look, I would like to know what he really weighs.
Yes,
he's,
I would like to know.
Yeah,
that
he's
too.
A chunky guy.
And also with Lillard, he's currently shelved with his abdominal injury. Now, here, that's a guy who does take care of himself, but he was having a lousy year this year. I suspect if he were available, that would be, you know, where I sit. I would prefer him over Harden.
I probably would, too. But, you know, it's this is so... And the other thing is Bradley Beal. I mean, we've heard... I just saw a lot about Bradley Beal in the last 24 hours, and I'm thinking, is that because they played last night? What? Why is everybody talking about Bradley Beal all of a sudden?
So.
And then they were saying Simmons and Maxey for Bradley Beal. I wouldn't do that.
I would not. At this point, I almost feel like Maxey's untouchable. I feel like that guy. And speaking of numbers, he's shooting 40% from three. Beal, who's normally a really good shooter, shooting 30% from three.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. I read that somewhere. I was stunned because he's a great shooter. But I think Maxey's trajectory is pretty straight. I think he's going to be a very good player.
And, you know, last night notwithstanding, they really have played pretty well for the last 6 weeks.
Given the turmoil around them, I think they've won 10 out of their last 14. So there's like five teams at the top of the East that are separated by a game and a half, and they're right in that mix. You know, Chicago and some other Miami, Milwaukee teams like that. So they're in the mix.
I remember a couple of weeks back we were saying, well, what are they? They're the sixth seed now.
Yeah,
if they have to play Milwaukee, they got no. Well, they're not in that position anymore.
And
I think some of the teams that are up there near the top of the East, Cleveland, maybe the Bulls to an extent, are teams that are kind of those teams that are in the category of taking the regular season very seriously in terms of having everybody show up every night and not a whole lot of load management, and we're trying to rise within the hierarchy.
I will say this about Chicago, though. They've had guys in and out, right? Like right now, Alex Caruso's out after that Grayson Allen fiasco. And he's a valuable guy for them. And they have an interesting mix. I mean, old Sixer Nick Vucevic is their center, which
God,
is interesting.
I love him.
He's had a nice career.
He has. I like him.
I do, too.
I've always liked him.
I liked him when he was with the Sixers. I really kind of hated that Doug Collins kind of buried him.
Yeah, Doug Collins did not like him. But
He's had a career. He's not going to be like a Hall of Fame guy, but he's averaging 17 and 10 for his career. That ain't bad.
Yeah,
and he can shoot it a little bit.
Yeah, he's a very capable. And he has a little bit of that low post thing, which not many people have.
So it's I'll be interested to see how the rest of this season plays out for the Sixers. I mean, I've seen people, in fact, Keith Pompey, who's been on this podcast fairly recently, he suggested in his Sunday column that maybe the Sixers should, you know, seek to flesh out the roster in other ways as opposed to the Simmons thing, which I'm not opposed to. But I mean, he used the phrase role players, and it's like I read that and I said, how many role players you need?
How many roles are there?
Yes. So, I don't know. It's a curious thing to me, but, I mean, we are getting, like, a peak Joel right now for sure. I mean, not so much last night against Washington, but he's in a really good...
That was a bad loss last
night. Yeah, it was a bad one.
Yeah,
it wasn't great.
That was against it, and the Wizards were undermanned.
Beal, and that was not a good one. I mean, they couldn't stop Montrezl Harrell in the fourth quarter, which is...
Please.
That's why you play him.
That's why you play him. All right. Are we good?
I think we're good.
All right. We've done it again. Thank you, Andrew Callahan. I'm Gordy. He's Mike. My voice is fading fast.
Actually, he's Mike. I'm Gordy.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Yeah. I'm Mike. He's Gordy. Let's review. See you later.
See you later.